deliciously delicious hello to you from sunny Vancouver, where the action never stops, even as we change our socks. This is Tom bringing you the July 2011 issue of Tomicide Solutions, entitled rather mysteriously, 17 Common Direct Mail Mistakes IT Companies Make. I know you are probably busier than a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest, but I also hope that you can take some time, maybe a few minutes, to review what's going on here, what we are discussing here, and you might even find some valuable bits and bobs here. So I'd like to encourage you to do that. So let's see what we have in store. Have you heard that every year 13 people are killed by vending machines? Yes, that's correct. Vending machines fall on them and literally squeeze the living daylights out of the poor bastards. And it usually happens to people who raid vending machines and try to pry the goodies out of them. So you can look at it this way, the revenge of the vending machine. By a mind-manglingly staggering coincidence, though, similar fate is waiting for IT marketing managers who try to pry too much out of their direct mail campaigns without doing the necessary preliminary work to prepare their campaigns for the best performance. They haphazardly put their packages together and then equally haphazardly roll them out to their markets. And quite often, the highly anticipated marketing campaign performs spectacular belly flop and falls flat on its ass. After this little incident, campaigns are often abandoned to their fate and die a slow and rather agonizing death. In this article, we look at 17 ingredients that are often missing from direct mail campaigns and undermine their overall performance. Mistake number one, missing what makes or breaks direct mail campaigns. Many business owners erroneously believe that the success of their direct response marketing campaigns lie either in the copy or the overall design of their mail pieces, and they are missing the boat. Well, they may be missing planes, or they may be missing cars as well, but definitely missing the boat. The design of your mail piece can be so ugly that people may think it's just fallen down from the ugly tree, hitting every branch on the way down. But if it addresses the right people using the right message, then the ugliness is irrelevant. Case in point, your neighbor pushes a dirty pizza sauce stained serviette under your front door with a message written in seriously broken English. Joe, you winning $10 million on lottery. Call lottery office right now to collect your money. Money with M-O-N-I-E. Now, how angry will you get with your neighbor for the dirty serviette and the typo-ridden English? I guess you get busy calling the lottery people and collect your money. Yes, some idiots get pissed off because of the way the message was communicated, but most of us with sufficient self-esteem just thank the neighbor and call the lottery office. Yes, copy is a major contributor to your success, which external copywriters can give you if you don't have the skill in-house. What no one can give you, and you have to do it, you have to do yourself in-house, is to develop a kick-ass offer to mail and a great list to mail to. If your offer is discounted running shoes and your list is a list of quadriplegics, then no copy can save you. This is why it's unethical to hire copywriters on straight commission. In this case, copy is less than 20% of your success. I would say 40% of your success is offered, the other 40 is your list, 15% copy, and 5% is the design. The irony is that most IT companies don't employ marketers who understand offer crafting, list building, and copywriting, but employ often multiple designers of different kinds, multiple web designers, multiple flash developers, multiple graphic artists, but they don't really have to work to they don't really have full-time work. They are on the payroll full-time. They draw full-time salaries, but they don't really do full-time work. So what's the point in having them? So in the best case, having amazing designers on the payroll, they can get 5% of the equation right and miss only 95%. But that 5% is much less than 5% because amazing designers run their own businesses and wouldn't even consider bending their heads into the yokes of employment. This is just that simple. Yes, I agree. There are some companies in the world that are worth working for as employees. There are probably 10 companies in the whole world, the most. Let's get real and realize that most IT companies, well, hell, most companies, period, are swell ships for their skippers, but hell ships for their crews. But this topic is for a different newsletter issue. In direct mail, your list is the market. Your list is your future clientele. So how much care do you take to assemble that list? How effectively does your marketing system filter and screen list members? The best you can have is the so-called house list. It's homegrown from scratch. Yes, it takes time to build it, but it's worth because it offers tremendous opportunities for repeat and referral business. Typically, homegrown lists generate 100% higher response than purchase lists. Why? Because in the eyes of your homegrown list members, your company is the respected authority. For the members of the purchase list, your company is just another vendor trying to flog its stuff. Because in the eyes of your homegrown list, your company is a respected authority, helping list members to make educated buying decisions, educated decisions about their businesses. For the members of a purchase list, your company is just another vendor trying to flog its stuff. This is a simple difference, but that makes it all. So again, we can choose how we want to market and sell. Either we sell as respected experts, or authorities, or, well, fungible vendors. Mistake number two. Trying to get copywritten using in-house staff. This point may sound self-serving, but it's just plain pedestrian garden variety reality. Unless you run a marketing company or advertising agency, there is no more need for a full-time copywriter on the payroll than a dentist or a chimney sweeper. Just as you use a dentist or chimney sweeper on an as-needed basis, this is how you should engage copywriters too. Mike Stelzner has published his research results in the White Paper Writer Industry Report, and it turns out that freelance writers can write white papers in about 24 hours, while in-house writers take 50 hours and non-professionals take about 46 hours. Now, the result may not be exactly the same with other marketing documents, but I dare to bet some vital parts of my anatomy that they are very close to the white paper writing numbers. This finding is significant for several reasons. First, many businesses assume there is a steep and long learning curve for freelance writers to bring themselves up to speed on the business. This can be easily solved by hiring writers with subject matter expertise and industrial experience in your industry. There are not many of them out there, I agree. There may be some industries where you can't find anyone. But if you can, hire those. Now, you will pay premium price for their services, but you get that much more and some more. Of course, if and only if you're interested in creating kick-ass materials that really distinguish you from the flood of the competition. In my case, my main area is as an electronics and computer engineer is the high-tech sector. But for the sake of variety, I sometimes write for fitness businesses. Just as a personal interest, I'm a certified personal trainer with over a decade in the industry. Write for extreme sports. I've been a skydiver since 77. And write about organic farming. I'm a joint venture partner and marketing guy and slaughterman / butcher with four local family farms producing organic meat. So I have significant experience in these industries. So I just write about that. Yes, you can save money by engaging in-house staff for writing, but what is it that they have to stop doing in order to start writing? This is the question here. What is the value of the work that they have to suspend in order to write? Some in-house writers are technical professionals without writing skills, as being part of the company's politics, which creates an instant bias. If they put too many salesy bits into the documents that they write, readers get pissed off. If they put too little salesy bits in, then nothing will happen. On the top of all that, most of them hate writing anyway. So, can they really represent your products and services to buyers with advanced technical or business degrees? I doubt it. The key is not to cut costs to the bone by hiring the cheapest people for minimum wage, but hiring highly skilled people to give you the highest return. That's the key. Sadly, many IT companies are still obsessed with cost cutting instead of profit generation, which is retarded. Any idiot can cut costs, but creating profits, that requires a bit of expertise, a bit of savvy. Mistake number three, trying to balance cheap copy with dazzling graphics. Just look at many IT companies and what you find is that they have several web designers and graphic artists on the payroll but don't hire copywriters because they think copywriters are too expensive. And to a degree, they are right. According to B2B magazine, the average hourly rate of a copywriter is $123 an hour, and this data is from 2002, so guess what, 10 years later it's a bit more. And with the importance and increasing demand of kick-ass copy, this $123 is no longer $123, but, well, more. And since in many IT companies the HR budget is not wasted on people who offer high return, but carefully doled out on people who offer low cost of hiring, low cost employment, most IT companies opt to hire the significantly cheaper web developers and graphic artists. Well, we have to prove to the world that we are a significant company, and for that we need headcount. So let's hire cheap heads, so we can create a horde of professionals here, and they don't cost that much. Well, they don't produce that much either. Side note. If you're a good copywriter, by definition, you should be able to get tons of clients for your writing services, and you need the emotional burden and the intellectual restraint of an employer no more than a fish needs a bicycle. Side note ends. So, now those poor bastards have designers falling out of the rafters, but they still can't produce the kind of high-caliber content that buyers would be interested in consuming. So they put one more flash animation on the homepage and hope harder for better results. Maybe they even start watching the movie The Secret, and then they hope even more. And if their luck doesn't come, they keep watching The Secret. Again, the same old mindset that has been cursing mankind from the beginning of times. Do the same thing, but do it harder and longer. Does it work? No, but it's comfortable, convenient, and relatively cheap and easy. And it gives people another opportunity to hope and pray for improvement. Again, and watch The Secret. Mark Twain put it so well when he said, thunder is good, thunder is impressive, but it's lightning that does the work. Similarly, dazzling graphics may be impressive, but it's kick-ass copy that rings the cash register. So, just like lightning, it quietly does its job of enticing your readers to read more and take action. Graphics can't do that. You can build a thunder of colors and flash on copy, but without the copy itself, all the graphics are roughly as useful as a fart in a windstorm, so you don't run far with it. Mistake number 4. Rolling the offer out without testing. One extreme of direct mail marketing is that IT companies don't do them at all. The other is that they do them without due testing. The whole direct mail campaign. They put together the packages that the key executives like. They put together the packages that the key executives like, as opposed to what works, and then send them out by the bushel basket. And while business-to-consumer marketers have deeply ingrained habit of testing and tracking their direct mail campaigns, most business-to-business operations have adopted a sort of fighter-bomber approach. Drop it and move on. So what happens? They keep repeating their mistakes for years to come. They end up with the same results because they fail to realize that improvement is possible. Business owners assume that just because one approach has worked on one offer to one market segment, it will automatically work with other offers to other segments. So let's look at an example. Many years ago, Mail Pierce created the direct mail piece for Good Housekeeping. For 25 years, no one managed to beat that control package. Then he applied the same approach to Science, Digest, Popular Mechanics, and House Beautiful. And the result? It failed miserably. As one of the greatest copywriters, Eugene Schwartz, is fond of saying, there is no answers in direct mail except test answers. You don't know whether something will work until you test it, and you cannot predict test results based on past experiences. And there is not much I could add to Eugene's wisdom. Nothing really, so let's move on. Number 5. Putting anything in the mail without a personalized letter. Has it happened to you that you've received an envelope full of generic junk but no personal letter? And then you are just standing there scratching your head. Who is this shit for? And who the bloody hell sent it? Because there is nothing. There is an addressee on the envelope to whom it may concern. You look at the sender, Behemoth Idiot Corporation. What is likely to happen to these pieces? Well, they'll end in the rubbish bin, most likely. After all, they are junk. And let's pause here for a second. It's only one thing that readers can deem letters to be junk. Quite often, senders also deem letters to be junk the way they package them and send them out. What do you do with junk letters? You throw them away. Very often, it's senders who condemn their mail pieces by sending them out in junk ways. Fancy envelope with letterhead, mailing labels, sometimes even teasers on the envelope, and the company name as a sender, and the bulk mail stamp. Everyone can read that, hey, I'm one victim of a big behemoth company's junk mail campaign. Well, then let's junk it. Tests have proved again and again that packages that include personal letters perform much, much better than self-mailers, postcards, brochures, or letters addressed to whom it may concern. We have to understand that humans are social creatures and they want to belong. And personalized letters with personalized signatures provide the sense of belonging. So what to do here? Write a letter without any frills. Put it in a plain large envelope so you don't have to fold the letter. Address the letter by hand in blue ink. Lick sufficient amount of real stamps on the envelope. Address the letter to a specific person and the sender write your own name without company name. Now you have a personalized letter. The chance of the addressee receiving this letter has just increased significantly. You can further increase that chance by sending it in a FedEx envelope. It costs a bit more, but FedEx envelopes have to be signed for, and by default they usually get open. And also with FedEx envelopes, they go straight to the addressee, not to the gatekeeper. Gatekeepers don't open FedEx envelopes that come from individuals to individuals. If that FedEx envelope comes from big corporation, yes, the gatekeeper opens it. But when there's an envelope coming to the big boss and the sender is Fred Cringing Nuts, then everything changes, because now the gatekeeper is not going to open it. And of course later you can make the letter more sophisticated, but this pedestrian approach is a good start, and you can start testing your results. Number 6, bragging about the seller company too much. One huge direct mail mistake is to brag too much about the seller company, its achievements and its products and services, how broke the president was when he started the company, how hard it was for him to escape from poverty and all that, how hard his childhood was. People don't want to read about other people's successes or their products and services. People want to read about their own problems and how to solve them. So if you sell CRM, write about how salespeople can better and more effectively communicate with their prospects and clients, and how that better communication improves the client satisfaction, client retention, repeat and referral business, and, well, the bottom line. In your communication, don't try to sell things, but open readers' eyes to concepts that result in better business and better life. So you have to facilitate the your letter has to facilitate the decision making. Your letter has to shape the buyers, the readers' decision making. So if that CRM can help users to increase sales by 25% without adding one single new salesperson to the equation, thus without increasing the cost of sales, that's highly valuable. That 25% is basically all profit. It's all cream. Now, in your case of selling complex, high-ticket technical solutions, several technical people will read your letters too. And for technical people, it's not only the outcome that matters, but also the process of getting there. So they want to know features and specs. Actually, depending on to whom you write in the company, you have to customize your letters slightly differently. Technical people want lots of technical details, but also remember that in most cases, technical people can't make buying decisions. They can make recommendations, but they don't have budgets to authorize purchases. In general, the more highly your buyers are educated, the more facts and figures they require. for those people don't even try what they teach in business to consumers, selling that mindless and endless emotional hot button pounding. They teach you that all you have to do, you have to find the emotional hot buttons and keep pounding on their hot button, terrify them, scare the shit out of them and all that, because sophisticated buyers can see through that veil, and they just turf your letter right away. While in the business-to-consumer world, it's an emotional decision. In the B2B world, it's a systematic decision. The problem is that the sales industry long time ago decided that a decision is either intellectual or emotional. So what they teach, and most business to consumer selling, is that sales is an emotional process. Well, keep the buyer in an emotional state. Well, in the business to business world, it's mostly, I believe, a systematic decision. The buyer has to make several systematic considerations. So before making a purchase, he has to consider systems and processes, existing systems and processes in the organization. So there's a bit more to it than either intellectual or emotional. Number 7, delegating your direct mail initiative to a committee. There are mountains of jokes about committees out there. Committees have designed the moose from a cow. Committees have designed the Australian egg-laying venomous dog-billed platypus from a duck, the bill, the beaver, the tail, and an otter, the feet. And for far too many years, committees tried to make communism work, and based on first-hand experience, I can confidently say they failed rather miserably. The funny thing is, there are still people out there who glorify that idiot Marx and that lunatic Lenin. The problem is that most committee members are not marketing experts. They don't know the concept of direct response marketing, don't understand what makes copy work, and have never studied the relationship between marketing and human behavior. Besides soccer in Europe and ice hockey in North America, they try to opine on something they know nothing all about. Not a sausage, not a dicky bird. The typical example is when these cantankerous curmudgeons insist that no one reads long letters and any piece of communication should be no longer than a few paragraphs, half a page, most. But history proves that long letters outperform short ones. But they can't outperform short letters because that's their opinion, and their opinions are more important than historical data and direct marketing principles. So that can be a problem. It takes an exceptionally smart business owner to overrule the prejudices, opinions of the committee and let marketers do what work. And it takes an even smarter business person to disallow the formation of committees in his organization. And when he notices there's a committee, then he sticks a stick of dynamite in the middle of the committee to blow it to kingdom come and making sure it never happens again, because committees can be harmful to organizations. So when the marketing committee comes up with modification requests, ask the members to support their request with evidence, and only then submit the request to your marketing folks. Don't let the committee mess with any element of the direct mail package until it's been tested on a small scale and you have results. Because as we know now that in business-to-business direct response, opinions don't matter. Regardless of the expertise of the person, it's test results that matter. Yes, people with experience can make better guesses, but they are still guesses. Mistake number 8, firing your biggest gun last. This point is about hiding your best and biggest benefit until the last moment. The problem is that by the last moment, your message has created a dull ho-hum effect. Using military lingo, no matter how powerful your big guns are, but if you start the battle using pea shooters and BB guns, then you're toast even before you could say Jemima Puddle Duck. In the brain, there is a primacy effect and a recency effect. They refer to the brain's ability to recall information and were extensively researched and coined by German psychologist Hermann Ebbinghaus. In the little scribbling below, you can see that on the horizontal scale, we've got the time, primacy at the beginning, and intermediacy in the middle, and recency. And the vertical scale, we have the comprehension, the percentage of words we can recall. So you can see in the first stage, at the beginning of, for example, a seminar, you can recall many words, and then the recall rate starts declining, and you have a recalling dead zone in the intermediacy stage, in the middle of the seminar, that the brain that blocks it out because it avoids, it prevents the brain from overheating. And then the recency cuts in towards the end. But the recall ability in the primacy stage is significantly higher than in the recency stage. So that's why we have to fire the big guns first. So again, using military example, military language, fire your big guns first and last. And in between, you can fiddle with your BB gun, pea shooter, paintball gun, catapult, and whatever else you have. Many in-house writers, due to not writing copy often enough, they write content but not copy, either fire the big guns in the dead zone or at the end of their letters, where recall is better than in the dead zone but worse than in the beginning of the letter. Research indicates that typical readers read for 5 seconds and then decide whether or not to continue reading the next section. So it's vital that your letter grabs readers by the eyeballs and seduces them into reading the whole letter. So how do you fire your big guns at the beginning of your letter? It's a combination of your headline and opening. There is one caveat though. When you write a big screaming headline on a letter, it screams sales letter, so on a rather short and fast trajectory, it quickly lands in the rubbish bin and your name lands on the company's blacklist. So place your bet on the opening by asking provocative questions, starting with an interesting fact, explaining the reader's biggest problem, arousing curiosity. Some copywriters start with the price first and offer discounts, but in 5, 6, 7 figure solutions, I don't think that's a good approach. After all, one thing we want to avoid like the plague is discounts. You'd better know your letters and your readers' attention hotspots. One of the hotspots is the opening paragraph. There are some others, and we'll discuss them in the other points. But for now, this is the end for this month. And in the next month, we are going to discuss the missing 6 elements of drawing the attention of the reptilian brain, the ultimate decision maker. The other mistake is missing the postscript, and other typical mistakes we're going to discuss is the mistakes of doing one-shot mails, poor follow-ups, relying on creativity at the expense of well-established principles, writing too much about you, and how to impact the 5 major senses. And this is it we're going to discuss next month. Hopefully you find something valuable in this month's issue as well. In the meantime, have a great month, have a great week, and then we'll talk in a few weeks' time. So, until, all the best, and enjoy the summer. And some of you who are in Australia, enjoy the winter.